Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hey there, it's Chris Bentley, host of Here and Now Anytime. Let me ask you a quick favor. It's easy, but important to me and everyone who works on this show. If you like that we're here every afternoon, bringing you fresh perspectives and insightful conversations on the big stories of the day, take 5 seconds and follow Here and Now Anytime, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And if you want to make us really happy and help other people find this show, leave us a good review. It really helps. And thanks. Now here's the show.
You have had these counter-protesters who've increasingly been confronting them, and we saw what happened late last night, early this morning.
Violence by counter-protesters and police at some college campuses, while others are seeing progress on talks between administrators and demonstrators. It's Wednesday, the 1st of May, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, we'll speak to the new CEO of The Onion about the future of America's finest news source. Also, a doctor-turned-whistleblower says a major health insurer pressured her to deny claims before she had a chance to properly review them.
The answer is hiring more doctors, not forcing doctors to make quicker decisions that might disadvantage the patients who are desperately seeking this care.
But first, police continue to respond to college campuses around the country where student protesters have been calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and divestment from Israel. We're going to continue checking in around the country today. Robin Young and Deepa Fernandez spoke to people on campuses from coast to coast this morning, and we're going to bring you a few of those conversations. Follow NPR.org for the latest as news develops. But we'll start in Los Angeles, where things turned violent after people in masks showed up to disrupt a protest encampment at UCLA.
Leave the campuses! Stop!
I only go study. You guys are blocking everything off for me. Let me go study.
Stop intimidating Jews!
Reporter Steve Futterman was on the scene last night and spoke to Deepa from the campus earlier today.
So UCLA Chancellor Jean Block called the camp unlawful, but it was peaceful. Then counter-protesters showed up, and it's reported they came with clubs and tried to tear down the barricades surrounding the encampment. What do we know about what happened and who initiated it?
Well, this has been escalating throughout the week. I've been here since last Thursday, off and on, when the encampment was first put up. And what you've had in the last few days are these counter-protesters coming and challenging the people inside the encampment. Last night, it just increased to a much higher level. They came not just with the megaphones. They started to take down the barricades. And the barricades were what was separating the encampment from anyone else. And that's when these fights broke out. There were fist fights. I saw people with sticks. There may have been some type of pepper spray used. We don't know who may have used it. It was some type of irritant. I had a bit in my eyes. Okay. Nothing serious. It wasn't tear gas. But that's what really resulted.
And we saw one professor tell the LA Times she described the group as a rampaging mob that attacked the peaceful encampment. Others have said campus security watched on but didn't initially get involved. What do we know about that?
Well, that does seem to be the case. They've not had actual UC police at the scene 24 hours. They've been here at various times, but they've had what you would call like private security people who are not law enforcement people trying to separate anyone who might come up to the encampment. And last night, when this got a bit testy, more than testy, it became violent, the security people more or less pulled out, and then you had some UC people here. The fight sort of went on without, when I got here at around 1:30, there was really no one interfering, trying to stop the fights from taking place. They sort of let them go on and simmer. Finally, there was law enforcement here, the LAPD, California Highway Patrol. They finally moved in, and basically, they pushed people out of this adjacent area to the encampment.
And Steve, we've heard from some of the pro-Palestinian protesters who are in the encampment that they had to defend themselves, and they feel like the university talks about the security of students, but they weren't protected. Has the university spoken out at all?
They've not really said much. They've been very, very quiet throughout the week. Last night, we heard that they declared the encampment basically illegal. We're wondering now whether there's going to be another move by the UCLA administrators to try to tear down the encampment, maybe like we saw at Columbia, but no indication of that right now. Yeah, it's been a very touchy situation for them. They are inside their encampment. As far as they appear right now, they would be very happy just to be there and do what they do, make their points known. But you have had these counter-protesters who've increasingly been confronting them, and we saw what happened late last night, early this morning.
Reporter Steve Futterman at UCLA, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, at Brown University in Rhode Island, a rare moment of accord. Pro-Palestinian protesters at Brown had been demanding that the university divest from any companies with ties to Israel. Yesterday, a student leader announced an agreement came after the school promised a vote on divestment.
Four representatives from the Brown Divest Coalition have signed an agreement, and we have gotten a vote among the full corporation during their October corporation meeting.
The corporation is the highest governing body at Brown. In exchange, protesters agreed to dismantle their encampment. Owen Dahlkamp, a section editor with the student newspaper, the Brown Daily Herald, is here. And Owen, just tell us what it's like there on the campus today. Did they clear out by 5 p.m. yesterday as they were asked to?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yes, they did clear out by 5 p.m. yesterday. The campus's main green, where the encampment was originally hosted, is completely clear today and back to regular student activities. There are a few remaining fresh grass spots where tents were set up throughout the week, but other than that, there's no mark.
And what is the sense you're getting from students? Do they feel optimistic about this? Or, you know, we're thinking a vote on divestment is not divestment. Do they think maybe it's a stalling tactic? Or is this being looked at as something other schools can see, a smart move for both sides, the school and the protesters, to find a way out?
Yeah, a lot of the student activists, especially the lead organizers that I've been talking to, are optimistic about their chances of a divestment proposal going through at the corporation. They have talked to several corporation members who they say are receptive to divestment proposals, if not outright supportive of these divestment proposals. But as of now, it's unclear whether or not this will go through. But if one thing's for certain is that it caused a peaceful resolution to this encampment, which is something we really haven't been seeing at other colleges around the U.S.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the sound you captured on Monday when these things were being negotiated and people were demonstrating. So there's the claim, the sort of demand. And now some students, we understand, are going to be able to negotiate with members of the board to have ongoing conversations. But meanwhile, do you get a sense of how popular these protests were? Did Jewish students feel threatened as they have on some campuses, or were there counter-demonstrators?
Yeah, there was very minimal counter-demonstrators or counter-demonstrations on campus, and they were mostly from community members in the broader Providence and Rhode Island community. I wrote a piece for the Brown Daily Herald on the second day where I interviewed prominent Jewish student leaders from around Brown University's campus, and some of them expressed dismay with the encampment, while some were actively part of the encampment. So I don't think there was one unified Jewish student voice view. It wasn't monolithic, but there was a diversity of viewpoints as to this campus. I will say that our university president, Christina Paxson, sent out an email the night the encampment started, saying that she had received no reports of any sort of anti-Semitic threats. But there are reporting avenues that students can take if they do feel that they are being harassed.
We only have about a minute here. Owen, I'm wondering, we understand your paper is writing, the charges against 41 students who were arrested back in a sit-in in December, those charges won't be dropped. What about any charges against students now maybe involved in the encampment?
Yeah, the university said that the encampment is not an arrestable offense, but that if it did turn into discrimination, violence, intimidation, or any sort of harassment, it could turn into an arrestable offense. As of now, the students are facing student conduct violations that are internal to the university's review process.
Yep.
But as of now, we are seeing that the students are not facing any sort of criminal charges due to the encampment.
Owen Dahlkamp, section editor with the Brown University Brown Daily Herald, concentrating on poli-sci. Owen, best to you, and thank you.
Thank you.
In New York City, Mayor Eric Adams is defending the NYPD for moving in on student protests overnight, arresting almost 300 people at Columbia University and the City College of New York. He spoke earlier at a press conference and, without evidence, pointed the blame for the escalation of what he called outside agitators.
We knew and we saw that there were those who were never concerned about free speech. They were concerned about chaos. It was about external actors hijacking peaceful protests and influence students to escalate.
Columbia has asked the NYPD to remain on campus through mid-May. Gwen Hogan was there last night at Columbia during the police response. She's a reporter for the nonprofit newsroom The City. She joins me now. Hi, Gwen.
Hey there.
So you've been covering these pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia for a couple weeks now. What do you know about the people who had taken over Hamilton Hall on the Columbia campus?
We still are going to be finding out information about that in the coming days. The mayor has asserted that these were outside agitators that sort of fomented the protests that were happening on college campuses here and elsewhere. At a press conference today, he was asked repeatedly for specific details about this, but he was unable to provide some. A police official said that they were still sorting through the list of arrests to figure out who was and who was not affiliated with the universities in either case.
We've heard it's very hard to actually get onto campus if you're not a student. Even journalists have had a hard time getting on. How would these kind of quote-unquote external actors be able to get on and be part of this?
That's right. I mean, at the time of this crackdown, press were not allowed on campus, had been barred by campus security hours earlier. I managed to get in. And also, I mean, right. You could only enter campus at that point if you had an ID that showed you lived in a campus dorm. So there is a possibility that people had gotten on earlier when there was more permeability of the encampments and had just stayed for days. So there is a possibility. But the vast majority of people participating, from people that I spoke to, were students.
Now, videos of the response of the police, they're in riot gear, they're using an armored vehicle to gain access to Hamilton Hall. Mayor Adams described the police response as organized and calm. Is that how you would describe what you witnessed?
I think the press's ability to actually witness what happened was severely restricted. As I mentioned, most reporters were blocked outside. I was in a central plaza when police entered, and very quickly, all of the students that were on that central plaza were forced into buildings and barricaded inside. So while there was a row of about, I would say, two dozen demonstrators that remained in front of Hamilton Hall, linked arms, and those are the students that were arrested. It was almost impossible for me to observe those arrests. There's some videos that show students being flung down or falling downstairs, unclear of what happened there. Student organizers are saying that some were taken to the hospital, but we're still trying to confirm all those details.
And Columbia has talked about very severe consequences, including expulsion for some of these students. We know that many of the students of color coming from low-income backgrounds, they're risking a lot. Tell us more about them.
That's right. I mean, a student demonstrator that I talked to who was actually acting as a negotiator for students who had received assurances that he would not face discipline because he was trying to act as an intermediary between protesters. He was suspended. He's a Palestinian student. Some of the students are on international visas. If they're arrested, that could have long-term immigration consequences for them. I know that, you know, in many movements, they'll try to put anybody who's on an international visa away from arrest risk. But certainly suspension and expulsion is in the cards for a lot of these students participating. Especially those found within Hamilton Hall.
And just remind us, it's been largely peaceful, correct?
That's correct. I mean, the main encampment, which has been going on for almost 2 weeks, you'd see teach-ins, music being played, a lot of people praying at various hours, Seder dinners among Jewish students and others. A peaceful demonstration, mostly of students. That's correct.
And Gwen, let's move quickly to the City College of New York. You were also there yesterday. Mayor Adams at his press conference shared a video of the arrests there, and it ended with officers taking down a Palestinian flag and raising an American flag. What should we know about the context there?
Yeah, I saw that video also. It was a very stark image. I had been at that encampment before arrests occurred yesterday afternoon. It was, you know, these are public university students. These are working class New Yorkers who were calling for a ceasefire, calling for their university to divest from Israel because of the war in Gaza. And so to see sort of this image of what evokes a wartime, you know, triumph by some military against what it was, a group of public university students, I think it's a very stark image to see.
Gwen Hogan, reporter for the nonprofit newsroom, The City in New York. Thank you so much, Gwen.
Thank you.
We also heard from a student reporter in Colorado about encampments there. You can hear that conversation at hereandnow.org. Coming up next, Robin talks with area man Ben Collins, who used to report on disinformation, but now is CEO of the satire publication The Onion. The truth may be stranger than fiction, sure, but fiction is more fun. The future of America's finest news source when we return.
With NPR Plus, there's more to hear, like extended interviews with some of the experts we talk to at Planet Money and The Indicator.
It's a mistake for economists to only think about economic efficiency when considering policies, because you'll actually wind up with a worse outcome.
And with NPR Plus, you help keep NPR going. Learn more at plus.npr.org.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
The Onion, that satirical news site that publishes headlines like, "Winner didn't even know it was pie-eating contest," has new owners. The Onion's been sold to a group of anonymous digital media veterans. What is known, its new CEO is now former NBC disinformation reporter Ben Collins. Ben, here you are, someone who ferreted out disinformation on a news network. What are you doing at a site that maybe could spread it? You know, maybe someone will believe a man just thought everyone was eating pies.
Yeah, I mean, look, my first instinct is to say, if you can't beat them, join them, obviously. But I will say The Onion, ironically, has been, even unironically, has been the most correct paper of my lifetime. They were, when it was deeply unpopular in 2003, were some of the first people to call out the Iraq War. You know, you go into now and they called out AI and abortion problems that are happening. Like the most recent headline they posted about that was Alabama Supreme Court rules that frozen burritos are children. They've been up on the moral panic on trans rights. All of these things that I would say the media has dropped the ball on, they have been very steady. They have a very steady moral compass. And also, they are probably the funniest people I've ever met. So it has been a very exciting time entering this writer's room.
This is fascinating. I mean, you mentioned the Iraq War. This, of course, was the war that was launched on the false information that there were, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and someone was sent to Africa, you know, to assert that something was made out of a material that it wasn't. Any of those things could have been satirical headlines, but they were true.
Yeah. On March 26, 2003, they posted a point counterpoint that was titled, "This war will destabilize the entire Mideast region and set off a global shockwave of anti-Americanism," versus, "No, it won't." Which is exactly the fight we were having back then. Yeah, and you see a lot of the echoes of that now. you know, we've been seeing a lot of the stuff around protests around Gaza. This group has a very finely refined bit of moral clarity, and that's because the editor-in-chief of The Onion has been here for over 20 years. People really love this thing. They believe in what it is. And also, we make really stupid jokes, too. It's not just all this incredibly serious
no
stuff.
No kidding. I have a few here. You want to hear them?
I would love to hear them.
Study reveals babies are stupid. So there's that. But tell me more about what you see as something that, you know, maybe undergirds what you do, which is pointing out absurdity or disinformation. Tell me more about what you see.
Like, for example, just even on the stupid stuff, even on, say, like Aaron Rodgers, the anti-vax quarterback of the Jets, you know, we have a headline that says, "Resilient Aaron Rodgers vows to return more detached from reality than ever," that sort of thing. We're removed. And that really helps. And that's in part because of the process here. I just want to talk about this. It's kind of an incredible, like, bit of magic they have where they toss every week hundreds of headlines into a Google Doc. Those headlines are anonymized. Then they go in the room and they talk through them to see which ones are the best, how they can work through them together. They do this every day. And then they go back and they find out who wrote it afterwards. And, you know, some of those are from old Onion alumni from, you know, 15, 20 years ago that still send in headlines. Like, these guys are, it's like one of the last meritocratic, truly, parts of American journalism and American life. It's really special to be a part of it. And that's how it's remained this funny for so long, yeah. Is that it's completely unpretentious and it's really, really stupid.
Give me a couple more examples of where you think The Onion will continue digging in a way that maybe you do in reporting on disinformation.
Disinformation won. There's no other way to put it. You know, Elon Musk sort of won the pipeline war with Twitter, and then he turned it into a weird, spammy bot website where lies and conspiracy theories won out. Disinformation won.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to fight in this moment is to, you know, take that language, take that verbiage of disinformation, but kind of tell the truth with it. And that's why we got into this.
Well, but let me ask you just in the minute we have here, is this why you've made the switch, Ben Collins? You know, you're now the former disinformation reporter. Is it because there's so much disinformation out there and disinformation, as you said, has won? And to report on disinformation is often to spread it by its nature. But this may be at The Onion, you know, again, you're not writing this stuff, but it's you're helming something that is maybe even a better way at going at disinformation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we got this thing to get out of people's way.
Yeah.
You know, this is an institution. We think it's an important part of American life. And we think it would just be garbage to go through an election without The Onion. Like, our whole goal with it is to make sure more people see Onion headlines. That's it. Like, I am just a fan who is now able to tweet their stories more and try to get them on television and do all that stuff. So that's really my whole goal. They have been the best truth tellers of my life. It's in their own way, obviously. At least that's on purpose. I think that's the difference.
Wait a minute. How can you say? Here's my favorite headline. Kitten thinks of nothing but murder all day.
My favorite one's obviously I can't repeat.
Ben Collins, new CEO of The Onion, former NBC disinformation reporter. Ben, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
If I start listing Onion headlines, I'm going to be here all day. But here's one. Jurisprudence fetishist gets off on technicality. Come on. Genius. Coming up, a retired medical director is blowing the whistle on her former employer, Cigna, claiming her bosses cared more about being fast than being right. Robin has the story after the break.
Summer is for going to the movie theater because it's too hot to stay home. It's for driving with the windows down, listening to your favorite music. It's for stretching out while you're on vacation to gobble up a TV show. For a guide to some of the TV, movies, and music we are most excited about this summer, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
The economy right now is bewildering, impenetrable, inconceivable.
Not when you have the indicator of our guys in your ears. In under 10 minutes every day, we simplify the complicated news, like...
How does inflation drop? What the heck is a SPAC? Why are trendy little high-fiber sodas suddenly dominating store shelves?
And more. Listen to the indicator from Planet Money and NPR.
pro-Palestinian protests have popped up on college campuses across the country. But from the eyes of students, what are we missing?
From the outside, these protests are painted as really violent when that couldn't be further from the truth.
I'm Brittany Luce, host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, and I'm inviting you to hear from student journalists who see what the rest of us cannot. On It's Been a Minute from NPR.
When the economic news gets to be a bit much,
listen to The Indicator from Planet Money. We're here for you, like your friends, trying to figure out all the most confusing parts. One story, one idea, every day, all in 10 minutes or less.
The Indicator from Planet Money, your friendly economic sidekick.
From NPR.
Most jobs have some way for bosses to track the productivity of their workers, how many products shipped out the door, how many cases are cleared. But the crass necessities of business take on a new light when you're talking about healthcare. A retired medical director is now blowing the whistle on her former employer, Cigna, claiming her bosses cared more about her being fast than being right. She says the mantra for people processing medical insurance claims was deny, deny, deny. David Armstrong reported on this disturbing news for ProPublica. He's here with more. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And this is truly disturbing. You reported this along with Patrick Rucker of the Capital Forum. It centers on Dr. Debbie Day, who retired in 2022. But before she left Cigna, Dr. Day said Cigna tracked every minute that she spent deciding whether the company would cover patients' claims, and that the company then shared productivity dashboards that put pressure on employees to clear claims quickly. And of course, the quickest way to do that is to deny them. You actually saw some of these dashboards. What did they look like, and what was she being told to do?
Sure. So these dashboards were sort of elaborate spreadsheets with dozens of columns tracking every kind of case that the medical directors, who are doctors working for the insurance company to decide if you should get care that your doctor has prescribed. And it also had a number at the bottom of each column on how much time on average these decisions should take. And at the very end of the spreadsheet was a rating, a percentage, calculated based off how many hours they worked. So the more cases you did, the higher the rating you got. And all the doctors at Cigna saw this rating. And what Dr. Day and others told us was the impact of this was to increase speed, to do cases quicker, faster. And she was told this and actually put on a performance improvement plan with a dire warning that if she did not do cases faster, she was going to be fired or face the threat of termination, I should say.
And we need to underscore, as you said, Dr. Day, she is a doctor and is employed because of her medical expertise to figure out if you know, claims should be honored. And you write, Day was, in her own words, persnickety, I would say thoughtful. But if a nurse recommended denying coverage for a cancer patient or a sick baby, she wanted to be certain it was the right thing to do. So she'd research guidelines, read medical studies, scrutinize patient medical records to come to the best decision, and this took time. She was then clearing fewer cases than many of her peers. Tell us a little bit more about her and how she worked, you know, what her job was.
Sure. So she, you know, like many of the medical directors, reviewed all sorts of cases. So, you know, common in health insurance is a concept called prior authorization. Your insurer is not going to pay for care until they say that it's appropriate or medically necessary is the term that's often used. So these are things like MRIs or surgeries, everything from, you know, a spine surgery to a hip implant to a stent in your heart, for instance, if it's not emergency, to prescription drugs, especially expensive ones. So she would review these cases. And the way she tells it is she took this review very seriously. You know, this is a physician prescribing care for a patient. And if she was going to deny it and say that it's not appropriate, she wanted to make sure she was on very firm footing and that this was a legitimate denial and there was a good basis for it. And that took time. And she did things like review all the medical records, look at studies. These cases come pre-prepared by nurses And in the case of Cigna, they use quite a few nurses overseas to do this work. And what Dr. Day said was less scrupulous doctors, colleagues, would simply adopt the language of nurses who recommended something be denied and go on to the next case. This was a concept known as click and close, because that was a way to keep up with your numbers. But in her mind, not fair to patients.
Well, you mentioned nurses. There was a team of Cigna nurses in the Philippines, for instance, and there's no pejorative to be read into that. But Dr. Day said she was catching errors in their patient files, glaring errors, wrong name, wrong body part, wrong disease. She said her bosses didn't want to hear about it. You know, it makes you wonder if the nurses, that particular group of nurses, were really nurses, or if there's a sense that everybody's going along to get along. I mean, you talk to other employees independent of Dr. Day. What did they say?
Well, and also we had some evidence of in emails and other documents where other medical directors were complaining about the work of the overseas nurses. Now, for sure, domestic nurses can make mistakes too, and they did. But there seemed to be a higher rate when they started contracting with offshore nurses. One other medical director called their report messes. Another one we saw said that they were very concerning, the poor quality of the work they were seeing from there. And of course, if you don't rigorously check the work of those nurses and there's mistakes in there, it could cause somebody to be denied care when they should have received that care.
Well, one would, you know, think, again, without broad brushing, you nurses in the Philippines, there's not a lot of oversight of this particular group of nurses that was working for Cigna if you're not overseas with them. Why were claims being processed overseas?
We don't know, and Cigna hasn't spoken directly to that. You know, when companies traditionally go overseas, it's usually to save money, to realize some efficiencies from doing the work outside the U.S. We know that some other insurers have done this as well. So I suspect that's the reason, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah. Well, Cigna has responded to all of this. They called Dr. Mm-hmm. Day a disgruntled former employee, told you there's no rubber stamp for denials. What else did they say?
Well, they said that they actually argued that it would be easier for doctors to quickly accept recommendations rather than deny them, which the medical directors we spoke to disagreed with that. They said it was much easier to just simply cut and paste the language the nurse had suggested to deny something and move on to the next case. And they said that there's no tolerance for that kind of activity we described if it was going on, that doctors are expected to do a thorough, objective review, you know, that's not dependent upon solely the nurse's summary of the cases. So they did push back on that. But they did acknowledge that in Debbie Day's case, that the dashboard, the productivity dashboard, was used to evaluate her performance. They said it generally isn't. And we also found some evidence that the dashboard was tied to bonuses. There was an email from a supervisor saying that it was at least a component of how bonuses and stock awards and things like that were handed out.
Yeah, well, and it gives more incentive to people to do it quickly, although there is some value to processing claims quickly. We know that. And there is value to measuring employee productivity. But we're talking about healthcare, right? Which, you know, means that incentivizing people to go quick can have a real serious consequence. So is there a sense that Cigna or the wider healthcare industry might be looking at a way to change this?
I don't have a sense that that's the case. And you know, you mentioned the wider industry. There is evidence of some of this behavior occurring at other insurers. We wrote a story last year about United Healthcare, and one of the medical directors there testified in a court case that he always just accepted the nurse's recommendation, that he never did his own independent review. He literally said that, I just make sure there wasn't a decimal place that was out of line. And an Aetna medical director a couple of years ago testified that he didn't independently look at the medical records when cases came in from nurses. So this may be an industry-wide thing. You know, you make a good point that these cases need to be decided in a timely way, right? People are waiting for medical care. Dr. Day and others would say that's true, but the answer is hiring more doctors, not forcing doctors to make quicker decisions that might disadvantage the patients who are desperately seeking this care.
Well, meantime, what should consumers do? You know, if you're thinking, wait a second, come to think of it, I had a claim that I felt really should have been honored. Do we have any recourse?
Consumers do have recourse. you can appeal a denial first to the insurer, and then there's often mechanisms to appeal beyond that to independent authorities. Very, very few people ever do that. You know, some studies have shown 1-2% of denials get appealed. What's interesting is when you do appeal, you have a pretty good chance of overturning it. You know, one study found, I think, 50% of denials when appealed were overturned. It's a very small number because only a few people do it, but people should consider doing that. If you and your physician think that this has been done unfairly or wrongly, you should appeal because you might have a chance of getting that care paid for.
ProPublica's David Armstrong. We'll link you to his story at hearenow.org. David, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR. Today's stories were produced by James Mastromarino, Koyani Saxena, Ashley Locke, Gabrielle Healy, and me, Chris Bentley. Our editors are Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Peter O'Dowd, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now, that's Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
On this week's Wild Card, we talk with Issa Rae about those moments where our lives could have gone another direction.
Definitely wasn't supposed to be with that guy at all. But I still think about it.
I'm Rachel Martin. Issa Rae tells us how to make peace with the path not taken. That's on the Wild Card podcast from NPR, the game where cards control the conversation.
In any great story, there's a moment that sparks your curiosity, tells you there is more to uncover.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
That's where Embedded comes in. We are NPR's home for documentary journalism, immersive and intimate stories.
I was stone cold speechless.
Nothing will ever, 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 ever be the same here.
Find Embedded wherever you get your podcasts. Do you wish stories could unfold over 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? You tired of doom scrolling, trying to find humanity? Or maybe a deeper understanding of why the world is the way it is? Listen to Embedded, NPR's original documentary series. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.